This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Baby Doom, the stork visits in speculative fiction.
Now, I actually pitched this episode to Jules last week, but she wasn't having any of it.
No, I said we could do it, but I also said it might not be a very level conversation on my part because I was suffering at the time. Anything to do with the female reproductive system at that moment, who was in high dudgeon.
Yeah, I think, well, I say we're going to come at this from different perspectives. I actually think we're probably both in the middle ground here, but maybe coming from different sides, but meeting in the middle ground.
Yes.
So I guess the sort of the prompt of this conversation was, you know, thoughts that I was having about Happily Ever Afters and sequels and things like that. And on one side, I'm kind of a sucker for it, but on the other side, it's a little bit archaic. And if it's not done well, then it can really, really destroy the characters. And we're basically just looking at having a baby in... Sorry, I say that like Jules and I are looking at having a baby together. We're basically looking at characters having babies, retiring and just having children. And in the cases where it doesn't work, where basically what's happened is that the female character has sacrificed any characterization she has, any autonomy, you know, any agency just to have a child, or cases where that hasn't happened. So that's what we're going to be talking about today.
Yeah, and everything obviously that feeds into that as well. So if you start looking at female reproduction as part of, you know, a speculative fiction arc, then you have to also consider things, or you should consider things like whether or not that feeds into the standard narrative, which is somewhat misogynistic still, and whether or not you're considering things like miscarriage and abortion, pregnancy in general, good and bad mothers, and whether there's actually a difference, or whether it's perspective. Too many times it's just presented as a solution to, oh, what do I do with this character now? Well, I need to prove that they're really settled and they're not ever going to leave the person they're with. We'll make them pregnant. You know, that's it. That's the coup de grace. That's the pinnacle of what you can achieve as a woman. Yeah. And I find that a bit toxic.
I do as well, because it's also the idea that actually, and we're seeing a little bit less of it, but it's the idea that babies are the ultimate form of happiness. And it completely erases the fact that there are lots of people out there, lots of couples who feel complete and content without having children. And they don't get later on in life suddenly go, oh, I wish we'd had kids. You know, they are just happy not to have kids of their own. That doesn't mean they hate children, but it just means that they just don't want kids of their own. And that doesn't mean that it's an unhealthy relationship or that it's an uncommitted relationship. And on the other side of that, having a baby doesn't necessarily commit you to a relationship either.
No, absolutely.
And lots of women do have babies when they're not in committed relationships, or they start in a relationship and something happens and they leave. It's just the idea that baby equals the final happiness, which is unrealistic. And actually very damaging in some ways, because it really, really does feed into a lot of assumptions that we have about parents and about how they cope with things, and particularly about how we deal and how we approach mothers.
Yes, definitely. I'm going to go very slightly off piste here and mention a book that has absolutely nothing to do with speculative fiction whatsoever. I've just recently finished it. It's called Sex at Dawn, and it is a fairly intelligent look through popular science and genetics and various other things at the evolution of human sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't go into too much detail because that was the whole point of the book, and it goes into quite a lot of detail. And I wouldn't say that I'd swallow it wholesale either, but it makes some excellent points. And one of them is the fact that, yes, we may choose to have nuclear families, whereby you have a male and a female, and then you have 2.4 children, etc. But actually, that's not really what we're genetically wired up to do. We're actually more wired up on an evolutionary scale to be in large sort of polyamorous groups and to all share the burden of child rearing equally.
Yeah.
And it's really, really interesting. And it sort of brings in things like, you know, those awful people who say, well, you don't get gays in nature or you don't get bisexuals in nature. It's not God's plan, etc., etc. Yeah. And it's like, well, actually, if you look at evolutionary biology, it would appear to be exactly God's plan or Mother Nature's plan.
Yeah.
And, it's not every woman is supposed to have a baby because we just physically cannot support them all.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that they don't have anything to do with child rearing.
Yeah.
So I'd have to go into a really, really long diatribe about it, which I'm not going to do, but I think it's an interesting point to say that if you start off with the standard narrative, which says that it should be male-female and everybody has children, then you're already closing your mind off to the fact that actually that's quite probably not how it's supposed to be. There's nothing wrong with it if that's what you choose.
Yeah.
But that shouldn't be what's enforced on everybody.
No, you're entirely right. And it's exactly as you say, because it's the idea that a child is something that's awarded to a functioning relationship, you know?
Yeah.
And it's the be-all and end-all, when in reality it isn't. And we know that it isn't, because we do actually get these instances of homosexuality in nature. And homosexual couples in nature raising children or raising chicks or whatever, or not. But I get a bit frustrated with the whole general narrative. And this is coming from someone who actually falls into that trope of sort of, yay, they had a baby together. It makes me quite happy. But yeah, and I think the real problem for me is it puts a lot of pressure on women, and it also puts a lot of pressure on couples who aren't the typical male female middle class. You know what I mean?
Yes, basically the Joneses, as it were. You know?
Yeah, yeah. Or the Le Blanc, as we call them in French. Yeah, basically them. Who are that perfect? Yeah, and as you said, you know, 2.5 kids, and everything's comfortable, and they can all go on holiday and stuff like that. And I think the other thing is that it makes a lot of women feel guilty for not having kids. Women are made to feel guilty for not having kids, and then they're made to feel guilty for not prioritizing their career, but then they're made to feel guilty for not prioritizing their kids. It's like it's a no-win situation.
Yeah. What I find as a 38-year-old woman, and hopefully it's going to stop in the next 10 years or so when I become clearly too old to bear children, but I find that ever since I turned about 28, the world and his wife felt entitled to come up and ask me, did I have children? And when I said no, why not? Oh, you're not getting any younger. Will you be thinking about that soon? And on and on. And it's the sort of thing like, would you go up to a bloke and say, have you had a vasectomy? You know?
Yeah.
It's that level of personal, of personal prying that, and you can laugh it off for a bit, and then after a while it gets to the point where I am literally stopping myself from tearing their heads off. It's like, it's a perfectly legitimate choice not to want to have children. I actually like children. I interact with children at work. I have a niece and a nephew. I've always taught children karate, and I tend to do quite well with them, but it doesn't mean I actually want my own, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's the fact that people feel entitled when you're a woman of a certain age that they will start asking you, and then they will start telling you that you can't wait very much longer. It's not very responsible.
Yeah.
So it's this perception that it is your duty to provide children. I don't know whether these people are paying attention to what's going on in the world, but we're actually kind of good for people. So children really ought to be really, really desperately wanted, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I completely agree. And it's also, it's the fact that actually, for the most part, we're very overstocked.
Yes.
Like, there are a lot of us around. We're overpopulation is a massive problem. And to be honest, I think it's economically, environmentally sensible to actually say, I don't want kids, so I'm not going to have them. And then people say, oh, you know, you won't be able to have kids when you're older. What if you change your mind? You just say, you know, there is this thing called adoption,
yeah,
which we need to normalize, actually. We need to normalize adoption because there are far too many kids in the world who were born to people who didn't want them or who couldn't have them or who you know, who lost their parents or their guardians.
Yeah,
we have
absolutely.
Yeah, so many kids in the world who deserve a home and who need a home. We really don't need to be going around producing more if that's not something that you're actually genuinely interested in doing.
Yeah, I mean, this is mostly said tongue-in-cheek for amusement purposes, but my sister a while back said, I'm doing a will now that, you know, she'd had my nephew.
Yeah.
And she said, you know, I'm trying to be responsible. And she was trying to say it so that I didn't feel pressured into anything. But at the same time, she said, is it okay if I leave Benji to you in my will? And I'm like, yeah, that's totally fine. And we talked over a few other bits and pieces that our listeners don't need to go into. But she said, you're not very high up the list. And I'm like, oh, really? And she said, well, yeah, I mean, basically, your entire family and a lot of my friends would have to die for him to come to you. But I like to be quite, I mean, my sister's very belt and braces about things. She's very organized. And I'm like, no, it's totally fine. If it ever came to that, then absolutely. So it's not a case of, you know, I wouldn't look after and rear a child or whatever. It's just I don't want my own. But it was so funny when she just looked at me really sheepishly. Can I leave him to you in my will? And then also, yeah, you're not very high up the list, so I don't want you to get excited. It's like, no, it's fine. I don't mind being sick. It's not a problem.
Oh.
So a macabre subject, which was delivered with a little bit of humour.
Yeah.
But but to be fair, yes, I like children, but there are some people who just genuinely don't and don't enjoy interacting with them, and there's nothing wrong with that either.
Yeah. No, that is a really important thing, you know, to distinguish, that isn't unnatural. It's not an unnatural thing.
No.
So I think that, you know, part of the real problem in fiction is that it creates this narrative which informs our opinions and which therefore informs how we normalize child rearing, and that creates a stereotype that doesn't necessarily have to exist. Yeah, for the most part, the stereotype of the family that we exist in, the family that we tend to see the most often, is mother and a father married with 2.5 children.
Yeah.
But the mother and the father married with 2.5 children might not necessarily be a good family, and they might not necessarily really have wanted those children and been pushed into it because of societal pressure, which actually ultimately is sad for everyone in the family.
Yeah,
parents
definitely.
Who have to sort of feel like they have to give up their dreams, kids who feel like actually they can't connect with their parents at all.
Yeah.
You know, it's just the idea that having a child is the answer. And having a child shouldn't ever be the answer. It should just be another part of an equation which already exists.
Yeah, definitely. And there is, I mean, part of the problem is some of these are urban myths that exist already. And the other part of the problem is that they then get reinforced in films and books and things, and not all the options are explored. And I can understand sometimes why you wouldn't do it, but having it as a default setting, as in, oh, well, they're happy now, what do? We'll bring another little person into it.
Yeah.
it is kind of irritating. I can understand it in things like, say, historical fiction, where you need to establish a dynasty.
Yeah.
And things need to be done quite quickly. And even to a certain extent in some fantasy historical fiction, I mean, let's be honest, George R. R. Martin, for all his faults, goes in some quite interesting directions when it comes to mothers and children. And yeah. They're not always very happy, healthy directions either.
No, but they are interesting.
Yes.
On the flip side of that, I can kind of understand that if you've established, you know, this happy couple and they are functioning and they are happy, if you're struggling to kind of think of an appropriate form of conflict, adding a child to the equation is a great form of conflict.
Yeah.
Because getting pregnant, giving birth, it changes everything. It really, really changes everything.
Yeah, definitely. But I don't think your entire character just gets erased either.
No. Which is something that does happen. And one thing I don't like is that I've seen several things, and I get excited when I think of, oh, the next generation, they come through and you get to see the kids. And I like that to a certain extent. But I also hate it when the parents are just put on the bench, especially if it's something where, you know, you grew up with the parents. Let's give a fine example, for instance, for those anime fans out there, think of Naruto, okay? Naruto, we started off with Naruto when he was about 12. Okay, when he was very, very young, we start off with this kid, and we're with him throughout this whole journey as he becomes this amazing kind of person. And then the series that's followed is Boruto, which is his son. And fortunately, we still get some action with the adults. But there's just this element of... We saw this thing which was, it just described what Boruto is, and he says, yeah, Boruto is the son, it said Naruto is Boruto's father, and we just went, oh, what? There's no way we went through all of that, all several hundred episodes, every single chapter of that for Naruto to now be sort of skimmed down to just being described as Boruto's dad. Because you just think, no, how dare you? There's just this sense that he's been put on the, you know, put on the shelf. And that makes me really upset, because I just think, why? Just because he had a kid doesn't mean that he's changed. He's grown up. And yet you will change if you have kids, because, you know, it's an experience that will probably change you. But that doesn't make you a different person necessarily. And it also, you know, it doesn't erase who you are and what you did, and it doesn't necessarily, and it won't necessarily make you a better person. That's the important thing to remember.
No.
No, I was just saying, so it really annoys me. Anyway, go on.
No, you're absolutely right. I was going to come in and say, I probably haven't mentioned it, but obviously Madeline mentioned a while back that she'd been to see Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, and yeah. I went a few weeks ago, and it is a fantastic production. Yeah. And one of the things it does really well, even though it was the thing that stressed me out so I couldn't actually read the play until after I'd seen it, was the fact that Albus and Harry don't get on terribly well to start with. And part of the problem is Albus is trying to come out from under his father's and his older brother's shadow. He's the middle child, and he has the worst case of middle child syndrome that I've ever seen. And it is, in that respect, even though it like totally stressed me out, it really was depicted very, very well. I mean, Harry doesn't suddenly become not Harry because he's had children.
Yeah.
And he still suffers a bit from the fame as well, which he never really enjoyed. But of course, his son can't see that. So that was actually done really, really well in Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, I thought, which feeds in, as you say, into everything you were doing. If it had been Albus and the Cursed Child, it would have been fine. But if they said, oh, no, you're Albus's dad, and it's like, well, yeah, otherwise known as Harry Potter, you know, the Harry Potter.
Again, who we grew up with. This is the character that we know and we love, and we've been through it all with them. And I felt like I really liked the Cursed Child because Harry still felt very much in the middle of the action as well, you know, from a different side, but he was still in the middle of the action. He was still trying to figure things out. And it was also nice because Harry hadn't just got it all sorted out. And that's something that I kind of really liked as well, in that you often get the stories where it's the next generation and the parents have just really mellowed out because they've gotten over all of the traumas, you know, during their journey. You know, they at the end of their book, you see them go, yeah, and now they're at peace with themselves, and they just seem to remain at peace. And I'm like, that's not really what happens. And I really liked Harry Potter and the Cursed Child because Harry was still suffering from the traumas that he'd been through. And yeah. And they were, as you would expect, you know, still something that really bothered him and bothered him more now that he was grown up as well, which I think makes sense because, okay, speaking from a very personal experience, you know, very personal experience here, I lost my mother a few years ago. And it gets harder and harder, especially when there are monumentous things happening, which would be the kinds of things that I'd want to talk to her about. So my brother's getting married. And, you know, that's a big thing. It's not something I would have occurred to me to speak to her about before she died, because my brother wasn't getting married then, you know. Yeah. And at some point I'm going to get married and I'll have kids, hopefully. And you know, there's going to be all these kinds of things, all these kinds of troubles that you're going to go through and suddenly go, gosh, I wish I had my parents. And in the case of Harry, he didn't just lose his parents. He lost his godfather. He lost his favorite teacher, you know, in Lupin. He lost a man who he really admired and trusted in Albus Dumbledore. You know,
yeah, he lost his father about four times over, ultimately, because yeah, he lost every father figure he'd ever had.
He did. And he didn't really ever really have that mother figure that he really needed. So it makes total sense that actually during the whole of the play he keeps having nightmares which involve Aunt Petunia.
Yeah.
Which makes sense to me because she was the closest he had to a paternal figure when he was growing up.
Yeah.
Because it's not necessarily that she was kind or necessarily that she cared, but she was perhaps the one who was more involved with him than Mr. Dursley.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, she was the one who insisted they take him in for a start.
Yeah.
But it's something that's quite subtle that I think a lot of authors don't actually realise, but you can have a traumatic experience as a child and you can be more or less over it. And then you grow up and your life circumstances change. And this thing that you think you're over comes back to bite you with a vengeance because suddenly you're in a position of responsibility. So having your own children brings back that entire traumatic experience of your own childhood.
Yeah, especially because Harry doesn't know how to be a parent because he never had one.
Yeah, ultimately. I mean, I think he makes that point, doesn't he, in the play. He says, well, I never had a dad telling me how to do all of this.
Yeah, so so I really, really like that because it still felt very much like he wasn't just a character who'd now been complete and was just there, you know, as a cameo.
Yeah, he wasn't just sidelined. It was as much his story as it was his son's.
Yeah, you still felt, this is still Harry. And, you know, a few people have pointed out, why was he so angry? But then at the same time, why is he so angry? Probably for the same reason that he was so angry in book five. Because this is a person who has severe post-traumatic stress.
I mean, there's that, and there's the fact that he's frightened. And I think people see it as anger and it comes out that way, but he's angry because he's terrified for his children.
Yeah, exactly.
Without going into spoiling it and saying why he's frightened. I'm sure you can find it online, but I'm not going to do it.
So that's an example actually of where the series has continued and you've seen a child, but I felt it's been done successfully.
Yeah. So going back to the whole, there's this whole I'm pregnant trope, isn't there? Particularly in speculative fiction. You have a female character. I can't think of very many female characters in progressive ongoing series where at some point she doesn't go, oh, I'm pregnant. And it bugs the hell out of me. It really does. I'd rather that the author just said, you know, either really went into it and clearly that's the direction they wanted to go.
Yeah.
Rather than, it's particularly an urban fantasy thing as well. Obviously, you wouldn't get males in urban fantasy going, oh, I'm pregnant. But they also don't go, oh, I'm a father very suddenly. Not all of them.
Yeah.
Which I suppose is the closest you can get. So it's irritating. And I suppose it's less impactful on a male urban fantasy character's life for obvious reasons.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, we should probably talk about Harry Dresden.
God damn it, Madeline.
Let's talk about Harry Dresden. This is spoilers for sort of later on in the series. Harry dates a woman named Susan, who gets turned into a vampire, but refrains from drinking blood, so she doesn't turn into a full vampire. And she's able to control her urges, basically. And she leaves Harry and joins a kind of rebellion group against the Red Court, who are the vampires. And she comes back occasionally, and they have sex, and then she leaves. And then what happens is she turns up at one point, she just goes, "They've got her. They've got our daughter." And Harry's there like, "What? What's that?"
What daughter?
And, and Harry learns that they have a young daughter, who the vampires now have. And he suddenly has to go on this very dangerous quest to try and get his daughter back, whilst being kind of a little bit pissed off that, you know, his his girlfriend didn't actually got pregnant, gave birth, and never at one point thought, you know what would be a good idea? For me to tell the father.
Well, I mean, I suppose that's kind of justified, but considering his lifestyle and his outlook, I kind of see her point too.
Yeah, no, I do see her point. I see his, I see hers. And she's going through a lot of stuff as well. And she doesn't even really get to raise her daughter either, which is, you know, because of the position that she's in. So she basically tries to limit her daughter's
contact
with both of her parents, because both of her parents are extremely wanted.
And not in a good way.
But yeah, it was done in an interesting fashion, because, spoilers again, Susan is actually killed at the end. I felt a little bit betrayed by it, to be honest.
I've not got that far.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. I now know what's happening in the next few books.
I'm so sorry. I thought you'd finished. So sorry.
Basically, I find Harry Dresden a little goes a very long way, so I've been really spacing the books.
Yeah, well, okay, so Susan dies. It's actually quite well done. It's very traumatic, and she dies for a good reason. It isn't just off the, you know, off the cuff, and then she was killed. She makes a very noble sacrifice, which is very damaging, but also ultimately saves the day. But it really, really affects Harry, and obviously it really, really affects their daughter as well. And a part of me really liked the way it was done, and there's definitely the sense of huge impact for what's happened. But another part of me was just there like, yes, you've done your part now. You have given birth to the child. Off you go. You have no more real purpose in the story. We literally brought you in to have sex, took you out again, then brought you in again to tell Harry that he had a child who was now old enough to, you know, walk and talk a little bit. And I was a little bit like, really? Really? Yeah. Because it would have been, on the one sense, it made sense that, you know, she had to be away from Harry for at least large amounts of time, otherwise he'd have figured out that they had a child. On the other sense, I just felt a bit betrayed that she left the story and then only came back for sex, really, and their daughter.
That does kind of encapsulate Harry Dresden, though, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Ultimately. And that kind of encapsulates Jim Butcher writing what he believes is a dynamic female character.
Now, I think we're being a little bit unfair on Jim Butcher. He's definitely improved. You know, and
okay. Well, bear in mind I'm only on book 6 at the moment, so perhaps he does improve and I haven't got there yet.
No, he definitely does improve. The case with the Jim Butcher is, you know, he started writing the first Harry Dresden when he was about 25, and he's openly said, yeah, I was affected by this, that, and the other. And he's trying to, you know, make a change now. But yeah, in this sense, I just felt a little bit annoyed that was all Susan was good for in the end, was popping out a baby and then dying.
That is the paradox, though, of women in, particularly in speculative fiction, isn't it? Because while, oh God, I'm pregnant, suddenly becomes a massive, massive plot point. Usually out of left field, because, or usually after they've literally just said, I don't want to have children yet. But because the author clearly doesn't know where they want to go next. And then what they do is, instead of putting a badass mother character front and centre, something has to happen. So instead of having, you probably haven't seen Farscape, because I think it's slightly before your time. But at the very end of that, Erin has a child, and Erin is this like real kick-ass peacekeeper. And she has the baby, and then literally comes out guns firing, holding onto the baby. And okay, that's an extreme example, but she doesn't stop being a complete badass just because she's literally just had a kid. But you don't find that in most speculative fiction. What happens is the mother gets killed, the mother gets into a bad relationship with the boyfriend, the child gets kidnapped, something like that. And she literally stops having any sort of agency. Mother gets killed is often the most popular choice, it would seem.
Yeah, well, killing the mother, and then, because we tend to, and God, even I'm sort of guilty of it, but the romanticizing of seeing a guy with a baby and going, oh, look at him, isn't he a natural with the baby? And we don't look at women and say, oh, isn't she a natural with the baby? You know what I mean? We just kind of expect it. But there is something very sweet about seeing your main character just with a baby. I mean, I love the fact that, and this is canon, within the Hamartia cycle, Zachary has this weird ability with babies. He can just make them stop crying. Just glare at them and they...
So he frightens them into compliance.
No, he's just really good with very small kids. He's just... Well, I mean, you see that in the books anyway, but he's just very good with very small kids because he has so many sisters. And he's just really good with babies. And he loves babies and he loves kids and he just wants a trillion of them. But, and I love that because I just like the idea of Zachary, as in Zachary, the one who goes around eating people, sitting around letting a little girl make him a flower crown, and by God, he'll wear it. No one is taking his flower crown. He will wear it. He will make his own. He will sing lullabies and hush a baby and stab a man all at once, you know?
Yeah. See, none of that actually seems strange to me, because I think that's a skill set that most people can pick up if they want to. And it worked within the context. But you didn't, and obviously you couldn't see my face when you were talking about that sort of, oh, isn't he a natural with baby type. And it's probably a good job you couldn't see my face. But you're right, that is a trope, and that's kind of a, you know, my eyes are going to get stuck looking at the back of my skull because I've rolled them that hard.
Well, this is exactly as you say. It's the fact that if you're going to say, my God, isn't he a natural with a baby, why don't we say that to the mother? Why don't we say, oh, you are, so daddy's babysitting, is he? And you're like, No, you don't say mummy's babysitting. Daddy is being a parent, just like mummy is. It's ridiculous. And it adds to the idea that if you see a guy with a baby and you go, oh, isn't he natural? That adds to the idea that on a natural scale, in a natural sense, men usually aren't good with babies. Yeah. And that's not true. I think most people, when presented with a baby, are not good with babies. That's the fact of the matter. It's just that young girls tend to be presented with babies or with tend to be taught the tricks of child rearing from a very young age. It even comes down to the shows that we watch, the toys that we're given. You know what I mean? It's a skill. I mean, for instance, I have a bunch of cousins, and all of the girls would take care of their little siblings. And the boys did it to a certain degree as well, but my God, all of those girls, you know, before they were age 12, they knew how to change a nappy, they knew how to feed a baby, they knew how to do all of these kinds of things. They were naturals at it, because they had to.
I was eight, so yeah.
Yeah. And it's just something that we tend to put on girls, historically, that we don't put on guys. So it's this idea that, oh, men aren't natural with babies. No, men just don't necessarily have the same experience with babies that a lot of women do because of the way society is. But actually, when presented with a baby for the first time, most people go, oh God, what do I do? No, no, oh no. Don't move. Don't
Yeah.
break it.
Anyway, so I've got a couple of examples of mother characters that stayed being the front and center of the story and were still pretty damn badass.
Yeah.
So I'll just briefly mention October Day from Shannon Maguire's Toby Day series, who we, she doesn't get pregnant during the series. She's already a single mother when the series starts. So that's a nice, refreshing change. The Toby Day series are urban fantasy, so again, nice, refreshing change there. And yeah, it's all fairies and witchcraft and evil wizards and vampires and things like that. So they're
All the
well
things I
worthy.
like.
All the things you like. So much better than Harry Dresden.
Oh, the tea is scalding today, Jules.
Well, I think it's because I'm trying to get through this sixth book. Anyway, there's also Well of Shades by Juliet Merlier, and that's an interesting one. That's set in Pictish Scotland, and oh goodness, the character's name has gone out of my head. But anyway, there's the girl character in it. She was sexually abused by her uncle, and on her 13th birthday, gave birth to a child. And instead of having the mixed feelings that we're taught to expect that you would have in that situation, she passionately loves this little girl from the get-go, to the point where in the end she kills her uncle in order to get away from him. And it's pretty brutal, there's multiple stabbings with a knife kind of thing.
Excellent.
And she is an absolutely awesome character. She's raising this 3-year-old child as a 16-year-old girl herself. You could argue that she is still a child herself in many ways. And she ends up being taken in as a nursemaid in the Brittany court of the king and looking after the king's children. And it's kind of a great adventure story as well as everything else. And there's intrigue and various other bits. And there's a bit of romance in there as well, which is fine because it fits in with everything else. And it sort of turns a lot of these things on their heads. And it does it in an interesting way for historical fiction, even historical fantasy, because we're sort of led to believe that having a child made you unmarriageable, which is utter bollocks, because that didn't really become the case until about sort of the 1400s. And even then, if you were a peasant, that wasn't necessarily the case. And back then, proof that you were fertile and you'd given birth and you could have healthy children made you a highly desirable wife. So while the circumstances weren't great, and in her case, the fact that she could rear a child quite well on her own made her an incredibly desirable matrimonial prospect. And the bloke she ends up with in the end isn't put off by any of this stuff, and they have a really honest friendship that sort of develops into something more. And he has his own separate relationship with the child, who sort of comes to be very, very fond of him, as a father figure. And it just, it's really well done the way it works out. I mean, she hasn't had special training. She's not a knight or a female warrior or anything. She's just literally someone who'll go for you with a pitchfork if you look wrong at her kid. And I really appreciated that. Because while it's all about the kid, she's still very much her own person.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the thing, because it sends out that message again, which is that when a woman gives birth, her life ends. And that's not true.
Yeah. No,
At
absolutely.
all.
And then there's West by Edith Pateau. And the first book, East, or North Child, as it was called over here in the UK, sees her rescuing her. Basically, it's a retelling of East of the Sun, West of the Moon. The second book, the trolls come back for revenge, or the troll queen comes back for revenge and kidnaps her child. But Niamh hasn't actually become a different person. She loves her husband, she loves her child, she's still really adventurous and likes to travel. And by God, is she going to kick some troll queen ass in this? It's really, really good. So, yeah, she still has all that grit and determination that led her to getting her husband back from the Troll Queen in the first place.
Well, I think the lesson that we can take away from this is that there are a lot of trop a lot of trops. There are a lot of, sorry, I'm having a stroke. There are a lot of I can't say it. There are a lot of tropes out there. About related to sort of children and childbirth and parenthood and things like that. And they're not necessarily bad tropes. So having a character get pregnant out of the blue is not necessarily bad. Having a mother character die and a father have to take care of the child, again, not necessarily bad. It's not these things about, it's the way in which you then proceed from that and how you treat them. And I think the examples that we've given so far, the reason that they've been so successful is very simply because they actually look at the reality of what it's like to have a kid and understand that, first of all, you're not necessarily naturally a good mother. But just because you might not be a natural mother doesn't mean you're necessarily a bad person.
No.
There's just so many elements to it as well. And again, we talk about George R. R. Martin. And I think Cersei's an interesting character. Because she's a character who has a lot of agency throughout the story. And she has outlived all of her children.
Yes.
She's outlived all of them.
Which potentially might make her more dangerous than anything else, because what she got left to lose.
Exactly. But it is interesting because she was very, very protective of her kids, to the point that even though she recognised one of them was a literal monster,
yes,
she still loved them fiercely and protected them fiercely.
Yeah.
And I really kind of like that about her, because she was probably, in some ways, she was probably a bad mother, because she really didn't stop her kids when Joffrey in particular needed to be stopped. She should have educated him better. She should have, you know, well, it wasn't just up to her, but, you know, she should have said no to him. She shouldn't have let him become the crazed, you know, well, madman that he was. But at the same time, she was a good mother.
Yeah.
She loved her kids. She looked after her kids. Her kids were her number one priority. But my God, she is not a good person.
No, absolutely not. I suppose going not off on a tangent, but moving on to a slightly different section of this. Mm-hmm. Yes, you're absolutely right. There's nothing wrong with having a character finding out they're pregnant out of the blue. However, when I see characters doing that, and they don't even for 1 minute consider having an abortion, I tend to raise my eyebrows.
Yeah.
And that's it, no matter what genre it's in. I mean, to be honest, even in historical fiction, it's not a case of it wasn't possible, there wasn't a service. As long as you knew early enough, it was perfectly possible.
Yeah.
It's not that it came without risks, but it's a, you know, fairly risky procedure even now.
Yeah,
depending on what stage you're at.
Is a fairly risky procedure even now. Yeah.
Well, absolutely. And I suppose that just really bugs me, particularly when it's in a teen novel.
Yeah.
Or a young adult novel, is the fact that, oh God, I'm pregnant. And they don't even go through the process of, I feel trapped by my own body, which is a perfectly natural thing to feel. I don't think I want a kid now. I'll have to do X, Y, and Z. What am I going to do with my plans for my life? All the things that we're taught to think make us selfish and unnatural as women, when in fact, actually, that's the most normal thing to actually think, until you get to the point where you think, well, actually, this could turn into a person and I would like to help that person live.
Yeah.
And you might not even think that at that point. It would be a perfectly normal thing to go, I'd like to reset everything. This was an accident and I want to do it on my terms when I'm ready.
Yep.
I absolutely hate the fact that, you know, there's still a stigma attached to abortion.
Yeah.
And it's a case of, okay, well, all these people who say they're pro-life, really they're kind of saying they're pro-forced pregnancy, and that the woman's life is of less consequence than the child's.
But the thing is, it's not just that the woman's life is of less consequence than the child, it's the woman's life is of less consequence than a group of cells that don't have consciousness yet.
Yeah, but obviously a lot of argument over where life starts, and that's kind of a personal, you know, you decide where that is. I personally agree with you.
Yeah, but on a scientific level, we know at the very least that there are some facts. Now, you can say, well, that they may not be conscious, but they're still alive, and that's fair enough. But, you know, you eat plants. They are also not conscious, but alive. So, you know, there's a lot of level of different things. And The thing is, I think it's really important to say I totally respect women who say I could not have an abortion. I totally respect women who say it's just not within me. But then the fact of the matter is that a lot of the women who say I could never have an abortion have never actually been faced with the situation where they might need one.
No, absolutely.
And I don't think it is going to be it's not an easy option to make. I think there's very, very few people in the world who view abortion as some sort of, you know, who view abortion as a sexual protection. You know what I mean?
That's utterly ridiculous.
Yeah, it's very invasive. It's quite a traumatic experience, as any form of surgery really is. But it is quite traumatic.
Well, I mean, even if you don't get to that stage of it, if you have a really, really early termination, it's a miscarriage.
And, yeah,
you know,
which is, again, traumatic. Miscarriages are not fun. The pill that you take is not fun. Okay, the morning after pill, a lot of sickness, you feel terrible, you know, but we don't talk about these things. But the fact of the matter is that this is not an idea that most people, you know, they don't go, you know what I want to do today? I want to kill my baby. That's not the general attitude.
No.
It's an incredibly difficult decision. And I say it's an incredibly difficult decision. You know, it's something I think there is a moment you can be certain, but I can think it can still be a difficult decision. You can still have difficulty, even though you're 100% certain that, no, I will have an abortion. But it's still something, it's still a difficult thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And not least because of the way women get treated when they're in that situation. And then add to that the fact that people say, well, you're going to regret this at some point in your life. And having known people who have had terminations, no, actually, quite a lot of them don't. Quite a lot of them have gone on to say, actually, that is the best decision I could have made at that time. I don't have any regrets. And I think that's something that needs to be said a lot more often.
It is true. And the fact of the matter is there will always be a few people who will make that decision and will then regret it. But then the thing is that actually, maybe part of the regret that they're facing is because of the stigma that they have been brought up in that they now think, you know, oh, well, I've had kids now and I love my kids now. What if I'd had my kid then? I'm sure I would have loved them as well. I can't believe I terminated them. And you just think, different time of life, different circumstances, you know, getting pregnant at 16, you know, and then having kids when you're 30, it's going to be very, very different.
Absolutely.
Very, very different. And the way we treat that, I think, will inform a lot of people who do feel regret for it later on. And if we actually didn't do that, they might have the chance to forgive themselves for something which was ultimately probably the right choice, at least for them during that time.
Yeah, definitely. Going back to the fiction side of it, the two books that actually I do think treat the subject very well, one of them's a mid-grade novel by Robin Jarvis.
Oh, okay.
It's The Whitby Child. And spoilers for anyone who hasn't read this, it's the third book in the series. But because of a bargain she was forced to make in the second book, Nelda, who is one of the fisher folk, is pregnant at the beginning of the third book. And there is a curse on her people. They will never ever give birth to a live child. You know, to give birth to a live child is to bring down the displeasure of the Lords of the Deep and Dark. They're a long-lived species. They live for hundreds of years. So that means none of them can have children. So they get married, but they're childless marriages, etc.
Yeah.
Nell does not actually much. I mean, in human years, she's actually about 77 or something. But in human terms, she's not much more than about 14 or 15.
Mm.
And so she was forced into this marriage as a child bride and ended up pregnant when clearly she didn't want to be. And one of the older sort of fisherwives takes her to find a herb growing in the graveyard. You can only find it on a particular night of the moon with a particular piece of equipment, and talks her through the entire process. Where it turns a bit dark is that because having a child would draw down the displeasure of these gods, it's almost like she's kind of being pushed towards having an abortion. So that was some very brave territory to go into on a mid-grade novel, in my opinion. And the fact that talked so frankly about it, you know, you might not want a child right now. It goes through the whole sort of you're feeling trapped by your body, you're isolating yourself from your friends, you don't know what to do, there is literally nowhere you can turn.
Yeah.
Written by a bloke as well, I'd like to point out. So you guys can do it. And it is just done really sensitively, really intelligently, and it does not put its punches on the dark stuff. And a book I read recently is a retelling of Tamlin, called Tamlin, strangely enough, by Pamela Dean. And it's set in America, Massachusetts, I think, in the 1970s at a co-ed college. And it goes through the entire relationship of Janet and Tom. And they start off being friends, they're just friends all the way through until... You can tell there's something wrong with Tom, something's happening, all the fantasy stuff is quite subtle with everything else. It's very, very clever. And then, even though she's been really careful and she's on the pill, and she sort of makes the move one night and says, hey, you know what? What are you doing for the next 45 minutes kind of thing? Because they do really like each other. They just, neither one of them, he knows he's going to die soon, so he's trying not to get into a relationship, but he does really like her. She doesn't know he's going to die soon, but she's waiting for him to make the first move and gets fed up of waiting.
Yeah.
And even though she's on the pill, she's been really responsible and everything, she suddenly finds she's pregnant when she shouldn't possibly be able to, and it's all part of the magic of what's going on.
Yeah.
And firstly, I was like, oh, for God's sake, you don't have to be that literal with the ballad, because I'd been really enjoying the book up to that point. And then it goes through the entire sort of, I'm literally just finishing my degree. I wanted to go on to graduate school. I had all these plans for my life, and handles it really, really well. And the reason she's pregnant is the only way you can get someone back from the Fairy Queen is if a pregnant woman pulls you down off the horse. And it has to be a woman pregnant with your child. And Janet reasons ultimately that, well, I can't get him back. I can't hold on to the kid. She goes through the whole sort of, well, maybe I'll have an abortion thing, in a time when it would not have been easy. And her parents are really supportive and everything as well. That she feels she can't use her child to get him back and then go and get rid of the kid. She feels that, you know, that you kind of have to pay the piper, really. So... It's the whole thing is again sort of swung around once more with the fantasy element, in the sense of her way of coming to terms with the fact that, yeah, I didn't really plan this now, but this is kind of the person I want to be with, and I actually don't really want to go through with an abortion. I panicked and thought that's what I should do.
Yeah.
So it was done intelligently, and you know, that was written back in, I say back in, it was written in 1990, but that's quite some time ago now.
Yeah.
Attitudes have changed a lot in the last sort of nearly 20 years.
Yeah.
So it can be done properly, and I would just like to see it done better, I guess, in more young adult and even more mid-grade novels.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, just goes to show you can do it in young adult and mid-grade. So, yes. We're actually running out of time.
We are.
But before we go, I'm going to talk about one more series, which is actually also my Dissecting Dragons recommendation for the week. And it is a series called Jane the Virgin. And it's contemporary with elements of magic realism in it. And it's a telenovela, which are the Spanish or the Mexican TV series that are very, very popular out in America among the Hispanic community. And it's great because it completely follows through all of the tropes. But the general premise is you have Jane, who has decided that she's going to wait until marriage. And she was the daughter. She lives with her grandmother and her mother. And her mother gave birth to her when she was 16 after a fling. So she has a very religious Catholic grandmother. She has a very religious Catholic grandmother, a mother who's a lot more sort of free-spirited and not very religious. And then finally it's her, and she's decided, I'm going to save, wait till marriage. And then she gets accidentally artificially inseminated.
Oh, God.
Which is, it's hilarious. It's really, really well done. And she ends up pregnant. But she's also about to get engaged to her boyfriend of 3 years. and the person she gets impregnated by is her boss. And this whole general monstrosity of a story sort of unfolds, and it's great. It's a lot of romance, and she wants to be a writer, and it's a really, really great series, and I'm really, really enjoying watching it. And the nice bit is that actually you follow her through her pregnancy, and then you follow her after she's given birth to her son, Mateo. And I really, really liked it, because even though her life is very consumed by her son, it goes through the very real things that happen after you give birth and the struggles that you go through. And it's still very much centered on her, on the romances she has, on the way she's feeling, on the struggles and her adventure. And I and even though it manages to tick all of those typical telenovela tropes that you would expect, you know, the sudden appearance of a twin and cheating and all those kinds of things, even though it and kidnapping children and stuff like that, it hits all of the typical tropes and yet still manages to be incredibly modern and very enjoyable. And as I said, the entire cast pretty much is Latina, Hispanic, and it's incredible. And large chunks of it are in Spanish as well. So really, really recommend that one. That's Jane the Virgin. You can find it on Netflix, so definitely check it out.
Cool.
And on that note, we'll say thanks very much for listening, guys. Please be sure to leave us a comment. Tell us, have you found, been disappointed by any follow-up or sequels which have treated the parents badly and have just put them on the shelf? Or can you think of any great examples where that hasn't happened? Please be sure to get in touch with us on Facebook or on Twitter or even on Tumblr. And thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.